Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The West Coast fires, how we're all affected, and what you can do to help the men and women fighting them. The 9/11 Fund to help first responders, including firefighters, what the Trump administration has done. And today on the show, the Iron Workers Talk Safety and the Nation Magazine on the National Labor Relations Board. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, September 17th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is AWF Union Podcast. We have two guests on the show today. Steve Rank's going to be joining us. Steve is Executive Director of Safety and Health for the Iron Workers International Union. He's also former chair of the California OSHA Standards Board. And he was selected by the Secretary of Labor to write new standards for the steel erection industry under what's called the Negotiated Rulemaking Act. This week is Safety Stand Down Week. Now, this is the seventh annual stand down to prevent falls. It was postponed. It was supposed to happen in early May. And it's been commemorating all this week. And the whole idea is to talk directly to employees about safety. Any workplace can hold a stand down. All they have to do is take a break to focus on what's called fall hazards and reinforcing the importance of fall prevention. Employers of companies not exposed to fall hazards can also use this opportunity to have a conversation with employees about other job hazards they face, protective methods, company safety policies and goals. And this is so darn, it's important every day of the year. It's even more important now because we're in the middle of this pandemic. And just to give you some stats here, fatalities caused by falls from elevation continue to be the leading cause of death for construction employees. Listen to these numbers. The fatalities account for 320 of 1,008 construction fatalities recorded. This was from 2 years ago, 2018. And you know what? Every one of those deaths, preventable. Every one. So Steve is an expert in the field, and he's going to talk about the protocol, what they're specifically doing for the iron workers, and what we need to do. Obviously, education is a big part of this. What we need to do to bring that number down. Again, they're all preventable. Michelle Chen will be joining us as our second guest. She is one of the writers for The Nation magazine. On the third Thursday of every month, we link up with one of the writers. This is such a great publication. It's been around since 1865. Not too many publications have longevity like that. She did an incredible article about the National Labor Relations Board and the very fact that this is a board that's sabotaging its own mission. This is an agency that's supposed to protect union rights. Instead, it's siding with corporate bosses. And in her article, she runs down all the different rulings. One of the biggest ones is the joint employer rule, which involved McDonald's and how they basically, the board has basically protected the owners of the franchises in various lawsuits. We'll get into that. We'll talk about the makeup of the board. Did you know that the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board is the same guy that fired the air traffic controllers back in, I think it was 1981, when Ronald Reagan became president? Same guy, union buster, in charge of the National Labor Relations Board. Believe it or not, there's a union that represent the workers at the NLRB. We'll talk about that. And some of them have left because they are just upset with the direction of this board. It's supposed to be balanced. You have a grievance in a workplace. Eventually, it goes to the NLRB. And you're supposed to take a look at the employer and the employee. All the rulings, just almost 100% of the rulings that have come out of this board since Trump has been president, have been on the side of management. Michelle's going to talk about that as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, we could not do the show yesterday. It was an interesting day. We had to do a repeat of last month's show, and I'll tell you why. We could not get a signal. I'm doing the show from Ironworkers Local 17 in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. And I've been doing the show here for quite some time because the pandemic is not allowing me to do the show from the radio station. All right. Well, we could not get a signal from the Ironworkers Hall to the radio station, primarily because Verizon, which carries that signal, had major outages over much of the eastern portion of the country. This does happen, especially in the fall. We're not in fall yet, technically, but atmospheric changes. What's complicated even more, the fires in California. That's right. If you're listening to your radio and you're hearing some dead spots or poor reception, it's because the smoke from the fires in California, which have spread to, Oregon as well, I believe in parts of Washington State, have gone into the jet stream. And it's affecting radio frequencies. It's amazing what's going on here in the country. And speaking of the fires, we got to help these guys. I'm telling you. Right now, 12 members of the firefighters have lost their homes. Imagine that. They're putting out fires and then, wait a minute, my home is burning. That's what's going on right now. Got a comment here from Frank Lima. Frank is vice president of the International Association of Firefighters. He said, our priorities always lie with the needs of our membership. I'm very proud of the work of the 10th District, reaching out to members and providing assistance as needed. We are in the process of distributing disaster relief and reaching out to all potentially affected members. Some of our members have not been displaced but need assistance. And here's the crazy part of the story. It's far from being over. He says, while the busiest months of the California wildfire season have yet to arrive, the state has already seen a record-breaking 3.1 million total acres of land scorched by flames this year. These current set of fires have already burned several thousand acres and thousands of structures. One fire, the North Complex Fire, stretches across various counties and has resulted in the deaths of at least 10 citizens. I'm hearing that number has gone to about 20 or 30 right now. If you can help out the firefighters, here's a website. It's IAFF.org/disaster. IAFF.org/disaster. I'll tell you, these men and women are doing everything. I mean, they're working 16, 17, 18-hour days, and then their homes are burning. Now, the other story. There are reports that the Trump administration has been siphoning money from the federal fund to take care of sick and dying first responders to the 9/11 attacks. The International Association of Firefighters released a statement, and they are so upset. They sent a letter to the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin. It's authored by General President Harold Schaitberger, expressing concerns regarding the failure of the Treasury Department to reimburse the New York City Fire Department for care provided to sick and dying firefighters at the World Trade Center Clinic. Apparently, the Treasury Department currently owes an estimated $3.7 million to the fire department. I'm going to read the letter here from Harold Schaitberger. He writes, on behalf of the nation's 322,000 professional firefighters and emergency medical personnel, including the brave men and women of the fire department in New York, I'm writing to express my strongest concern regarding the failure of the Treasury Department to reimburse the fire department for care provided to sick and dying firefighters. It's my understanding that the Treasury currently owes the department $3.7 million, and this matter has been brought to your attention by the fire department, members of Congress, and others to no avail. The Fire Department of New York World Trade Center Clinic provides comprehensive physical and mental health services to all active and retired members who responded to the 9/11 attacks. As you know, the health impacts on 9/11 responders are significant and far-reaching. In addition to the 343 firefighters who died on that fateful day 19 years ago, 226 members have since died in the line of duty because of 9/11 illnesses. Thousands more suffer daily from lung diseases, cancers, gastrointestinal diseases, mental health ailments, and many other ailments. Now, we just commemorated the 19th anniversary. Harold writes, the failure of your department to act is offensive and completely unacceptable. The Treasury Department must act immediately to reimburse the department for their services to firefighters made ill by the response and recovery efforts at the World Trade Center. Thank you for your attention and to this critically important matter. I look forward to a prompt response. So far, we have not heard of any response on that. You know what? That is shameful. Absolutely shameful. Unbelievable. I don't know what else to say. That's a lot of money to be withholding from people that are sick and dying. Speaking of the firefighters, the union is broadcasting its Fallen Firefighter Memorial Virtual Remembrance. It's going to be this Saturday, 2 days from now. Going to take place at 11 a.m. Mountain Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And this is all to honor members who have fallen in the line of duty and whose names will forever be etched into the union's Wall of Honor. The Wall of Honor apparently is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. It's an annual memorial event. And again, not being held in person this year due to the pandemic, but the firefighters are encouraging members and friends to create their own video or photo in tribute to those who have been lost this year. All right. You can get some more information on that by going to the International Association of Firefighter website, IAFF.org, IAFF.org. They also have a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Steve Rank talking safety with the ironworkers coming up next. Don't go away.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective Democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. Don't forget we're available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. By the way, in the latest edition of the Iron Worker magazine, our next guest is with the Iron Workers International Union. General President Eric Dean praised the work members who have been performing throughout this pandemic and gave an update on what the union is doing to respond to COVID-19. He said the union staff in every department has been working to help individual members with their employment and safety concerns. He also pointed out the union has been implementing new policies and procedures to keep members safe on the job site. Boy, that is job number one. This is a quote from the magazine. You might not hear much about it, but take note, the bridges we build, the hospitals we construct, the wind turbines we erect, the metalwork we produce is essential, 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 essential. There's no denying that, said Dean. Iron workers are and will always be essential workers of North America. God bless him for saying that. Let's go to our live line right now. And this guy is very essential to America's workforce. He's our first guest, Steve Rank. He is the Executive Director of Safety and Health for the International Union of the Iron Workers. Steve Rank, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
And you have to know that I am recording the show at Iron Workers Local 17 in the union-friendly town of Cleveland, Ohio. I just had to get that out of my mouth right away. Okay. Steve, thanks for joining us today. Talk to me about your role as Executive Director of Safety and Health. How long have you been involved in this, and essentially, how are you carrying out your mission here?
I've been in the role of Safety and Health for the Iron Workers for nearly 30 years now. But I've been with the Iron Workers International since about 2002, and it's been a great, great learning experience to help prevent these fatalities and disabling injuries that unfortunately occurred during the steel erection process. We are probably the most high-hazard construction industry there is. When you think about erecting 40, 50-story buildings or bridges over rivers, and the type of work that we do, it takes a lot of skill, it takes a lot of training, and it takes a lot of safety. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt someone else. And my job is to try to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. To your point, Steve, I was reading earlier about the fatalities caused by falls from elevation, and the statistics come from 2 years ago. 320 of the 1,008 construction fatalities recorded from 2018. Apparently, those deaths were preventable. Every one of those deaths were preventable, I take it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, not in all cases. In some cases, and those numbers may be across all building trades, not just the iron workers.
Okay.
We have our own fatality data, as well as any other building trade. So I believe the number that you have represents, quote, construction workers, perhaps. But they're not always falls. You could get knocked off the building, okay? You could have structural collapse and fall and hit the ground. So it's very, very important that you look at these causation factors of how did our worker get hurt or killed. Mm-hmm. In many cases, and this is one of the problems that we have, is misclassification during the fatality investigation. So you have to look very carefully, and I'm not talking about people within the iron workers, but other people that investigate fatality scenes. You have to look at the root causes. Did they merely fall, or did they trip? Did they fall, or did they get knocked off because of a moving load they're working with the crane? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of factors here you got to look at. But yes, falls in general is an exposure that iron workers have every day.
Yeah,
our walking working surface is not a poured concrete floor. Our walking working surface is a 4 to 6 inch wide flange beam, because we're building the beam to column connections. We're building the structural steel framework for other trades to follow up behind us to put concrete in and all that. So that is our walking working surface. So yes, falls presents a real challenge to iron workers in the field. So one of my jobs is to make sure that we address falls, fall hazards, training, what's the latest, greatest equipment on in market today, and how do we train our members coming up through the ranks so they can have a career with us for 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. How are you going to survive the hazards over a period of 25 years? That's my role.
Steve, I mean, you mentioned that you've been with the iron workers for 30 years. Are we getting better at this, the training? I mean, obviously, you're putting your heart and soul in this. You want to protect your union brothers and sisters. What's the status right now in 2020?
We are getting better. And just the one area of just falls, the iron workers have developed what we call a fall protection training structure. It's a two-story structure that's built at the apprenticeship training facilities, 156 of them in North America. So when the iron workers learn how to assemble a mock two-story building, it's also used as a fall protection training structure. And while they do this work, they use every type of fall arrest equipment on today's market. They use retractable lanyards. They use beamer devices. They use stanchion posts, horizontal lifelines. They use every type of fall arrest equipment as they build this mock two-story structure. So, we have advanced. We have done better. But we get back to just one or two issues. You have to use your fall protection, and you have to use it correctly. Mm-hmm. You could be wearing it, but if you don't use it right, it simply doesn't work.
Gotcha. This week is Safety Stand Down Week. This was originally scheduled for May, but the pandemic has changed everything as we know. Talk to me about Safety Stand Down Week. It's my understanding this is a voluntary event for employers. I'm just wondering, are employers, you know, conveying that message of safety to the workers? What are you hearing?
It is. It's a big thing. It's an event. Our general president Eric Dean sent a letter out this week to every district council and local union in North America, urging them that in their conversations with contractors, our good contractors, our employers, our members, that just remember that falls remains the highest percentage of fatalities in the construction industry, and that if they need upgrading training on new technologies, to please go back to the training facilities. So, yes, our general president took the lead to put this letter out and instruct people to be mindful this week that we have the facilities, we have the training, we have everything available to them, so let's use it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did that this year as well as he does every year. Is we take a role in this. We offer our training facilities up to OSHA and other people to come in to use for these stand downs. But unfortunately, because of the pandemic, we were unable to let large crowds into our training facilities throughout North America. So we regret, hopefully next year, during this time, this week, we can reopen the training facilities and let employers come in, regulatory folks, to talk about falls in the workplace.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to note that Safety Stand Down Week is created by the Department of Labor, especially primarily the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And I'm sure you have heard some criticisms. I mean, we've been doing a number of shows here about OSHA and the fact that they seem to be lax and kind of neutered, so to speak, under the Trump administration when it comes to worker safety. I'd like to get your point of view. What are you hearing on your side?
Well, you know, have dealt with this for so many years that your typical compliance officer may not know steel erection like they know other types of aspects of safety and health. So it's really how much are they trained? How much do they understand the steel erection industry? And how much do they know the standards that apply to the work that we do? That's very important. I'm not sure if they're lax as much as they are just unqualified and unable to address the issue that they're looking at. Mm-hmm. We have such a complex industry. We do everything from controlled decking zones to multiple lift rigging to different trigger heights for fall protection for connectors who have some discretion because they're working with incoming loads that are hoisted by a crane. So we have a lot of things to contend with, but in many cases, our problem is we have OSHA compliance officers that haven't been trained or they don't understand the work that we do and the differences in our standards from other construction standards. So that has been a problem in general.
Steve, there's a lot to unwind there. You know what? I'm going to have to set you up for another show here on America's Workforce because we've got some issues that need to be addressed. I really appreciate you coming to the table today. Steve Rank, Executive Director of Safety and Health on behalf of the Iron Workers International Union. You take care and you be safe and stay in touch, okay?
Thanks for all you do to bring safety and health to the attention of all your listeners. We appreciate what you do for the construction industry.
Okay, buddy. You take care. All right, Steve Rank on our live line. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michelle Chen will be joining us on behalf of The Nation magazine talking about the National Labor Relations Board. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. And don't forget, we're available on various platforms. And that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Twitter handle is AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to our live line and join Michelle Chen. Michelle is with The Nation magazine. She's been there for about 5 years. And she's here to talk about her most recent article. And this is a subject that is very near and dear to me. And those of you listening, you union brothers and sisters, you have to pay close attention to what the Trump administration has done since 2017 to the National Labor Relations Board. And her article is titled, Trump's National Labor Relations Board is Sabotaging Its Own Mission. Michelle, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, before we get into your article here, I notice that this article, very lengthy, was in partnership with Type Investigations with support from the Puffin Foundation? I need you to explain a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Type Investigations sort of grew out of the Investigative Fund, which was a sort of a grant program started by The Nation to basically support journalists doing more investigative long-form pieces. So, you know, this would be an example, you know, longer than maybe, you know, your average labor news piece that you might see in the news. They generally support all sorts of investigative projects by progressive journalists, looking at issues, you know, about civil rights, immigration, you know, civil liberties, and digging into what the federal government is doing. Mm-hmm. This is one of those pieces. So they don't always support pieces that go in The Nation. They support progressive journalists trying to get into all sorts of publications so that, journalism from a progressive perspective can have a wider readership.
Yeah, and we need those kind of investigations, no doubt about it. Did they push you toward the National Labor Relations Board, or was this something you wanted to do?
No, actually, oddly enough, I had been sort of mildly obsessed with this rather obscure agency in the federal government, I brought it to them because they've been doing different investigative pieces on different aspects of the federal government under Trump, and I thought that what Trump is doing in terms of labor rights has been, you know, both kind of stunning in how sweeping some of the measures have been, but also a little bit under the radar, because a lot of this stuff deals with aspects of labor law that, you know, a lot of people don't understand unless maybe they're, you know, a business agent for their union or a legal counsel for a union or a management side lawyer, right? So so I thought I'd just do a little dive into what the agency has been doing under Trump, how it's evolved, and how that affects our rights as workers on a daily basis.
Yeah, and you report that the NLRB is sabotaging its own mission. Now, keep in mind, this is a board that was created back in the Great Depression. We're talking, 1935, and it was designed to more or less protect workers at that time. And with different administrations, when there's a Republican in the White House, it's usually a five-member board, so there's three Republicans, two Democrats, and now we have Donald Trump. And from what I understand, there's three Republicans, and two of them, aren't they from, union-busting law firms?
Yeah, it's not unusual to have management-side lawyers serve on the NLRB under conservative administrations, but, the three members who currently dominate the board, and there's one vacant seat, by the way, and there's another Democrat that they have kind of, sort of slotted in there, kind of the perfunctory Democrat. But the three members of the board who currently dominate it, two of them are from management side labor employment firms that have been defending, you know, pretty big corporations. And the general counsel, Peter Robb, who is sort of the chief prosecutor of the NLRB and really brings cases before the board, he has a rather long history of defending management and representing big corporations. And he actually goes back quite a ways with the NLRB. He worked with the Reagan administration was involved in the PATCO strike, which some of your listeners may remember was one of the big sort of standoffs that the Reagan administration had with organized labor. And many people sort of attribute the decline of unions with beginning at that point where Reagan had his clash with the air traffic controller union.
Now you're referring to Peter Robb, right? That's the general counsel for the NLRB.
Yeah.
So the guy that broke up the air traffic controllers in 1981 is the general counsel. He's kind of like the gatekeeper at the NLRB. So if there's a case that may be in favor of unions or a union grievance that they want to have the NLRB investigate, he can say, you know what? I don't think we're going to move forward. And that's pretty much the end of the case, right?
Yeah, the general counsel has a lot of power to intervene in cases. So just to step back a little bit, the structure of the NLRB is basically there's a lot of litigation that happens at the regional level. So, there are 26 regions in, within the National Labor Relations Board's scope. And in each of those regions, they have staff lawyers and administrative and that bring cases before administrative law judges. And so the vast majority of cases get either resolved or settled, through that regional level kind of apparatus. A small fraction of those cases go before the big board in D.C. And Peter Robb, as general counsel, can bring cases up to the board. And given that he seems to be siding with management a lot of the time, it's been interesting to see how the general counsel, who is supposed to be sort of representing bringing cases before the board on behalf of workers, has ended up moving to get cases dismissed when they turn on an important issue of workplace rights, and or has been elevating cases brought by management in order to suppress or undermine unions, and has been facilitating those cases as well.
So they're heavy-handed against unions. That's pretty much what's going on here. Any rulings? In your article, you reflect on several of them. One is the joint employer standard, where I guess under Obama, President Obama, the board loosened the joint employer standard, which determines whether a company can be considered an additional employer of workers hired through a contractor, like a franchise operator, like a McDonald's or something. Now, that was pretty much a significant turnabout, wasn't it?
It was a pretty significant turnaround because that case was kind of a watershed. So back in 2015, there had been a landmark ruling that sort of broadened the joint employer standard under Obama. So they basically loosened the criteria so that more employers could be held accountable as joint employers of groups of workers. So, if there's, say, a warehouse and some groups, and there's a union representing the directly employed workers of that warehouse company, and then they bring on a bunch of other workers through a contractor, right? They sort of subcontract out a certain section of the warehouse to hire more workers. Those workers aren't necessarily on the payroll of the parent company, right? But you can imagine a scenario in which the parent company has significant control over those subcontracted workers anyway. So a loosening of the joint employer standard would create a broader criteria by which the workers who are subcontracted would be able to enter into collective bargaining talks with the parent company. So in the case of, this was seen as a watershed for the Fight for 15 movement, because in the case of a big fast food company like McDonald's, you might think that when you walk into McDonald's and you see people wearing the McDonald's uniform and it's got the golden arches outside, that those are McDonald's workers who are taking your order. But in fact, they are employees of the franchise operator. So what McDonald's does, and their business model is very clever in this way, they basically run the vast majority of their McDonald's through franchise operators. And the franchise operators end up becoming the sort of the main bosses. But under a looser joint employer standard, McDonald's workers across the country would be able to theoretically perhaps collectively bargain with McDonald's itself. And that would be massive for the Fight for 15 movement, which has been trying to unify this labor force and raise standards and working conditions and get unionization for workers across the board, across the McDonald's sort of empire. The current National Labor Relations Board rolled back that standard so that the case of workers trying to hold McDonald's accountable as a joint employer, that was forced into a settlement that basically, you know, didn't address the joint employer issue at all and basically just provided like back pay for the workers who had brought their case. So, you know, Peter Robb was able to kind of steer that case into a settlement that ended up not really being nearly as significant for workers' rights as the Fight for 15 had hoped when they brought the case under Obama.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just one of many cases. They try to reverse everything that Obama did while in office. It's really sad. You know, the crazy thing about this, Michelle, is there's a couple of unions that represent the workers at the NLRB. I want to hold that for the next segment. Can you stay with us for some more time here on America's Workforce? Okay, Michelle Chen is her name, and she is the author of an article in The Nation magazine, Trump's National Labor Relations Board is Sabotaging Its Own Mission. We'll continue the conversation right after this. Once again, you're listening to America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers. Standing strong and fighting for what's right.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And we're back with America's Workforce. Don't forget our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. You can follow us there. And we are available, once again, on various platforms. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, just to name a few. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Michelle Chen. Michelle is one of the great writers at The Nation magazine. On the third Thursday of each and every month, we focus on one of the writers there at The Nation. And I've been following your writing for a long time. I really appreciate you being on the show today. And we're talking about the National Labor Relations Board. And her article is about how the board is sabotaging its own mission and the rulings that under the Trump administration have pretty much reversed anything that was pro-worker during the Obama administration. And there's a slew of rulings that we could get into. The crazy part about this, Michelle, is that I guess a lot of people at the agency are really upset. A number of them have left. I want to get into that. But there's what, two unions that represent the workers at the National Labor Relations Board? Is that right?
Yeah, these are interestingly, they're public sector unions, obviously, because they work for the federal government. So they do not fall under the National Labor Relations Board's jurisdiction, because National Labor Relations Board deals with private sector employees. But yes, you're not the first person to observe the irony of the National Labor Relations Board busting the unions that represent its own employees. But yes, the there have been issues that have been raised, basically since the General Counsel, Peter Robb, started his term. There have been efforts, subtle efforts to kind of restructure or reorganize. They would say that it's not restructuring. They would just simply say that they're, tweaking their operations. But there have been moves to centralize the authority of the National Labor Relations Board so that the regional directors have less authority. And that's significant because by diminishing the authority of the regional directors, you're really diminishing the authority of the career civil service staff that have been working through often multiple administrations. And they are generally seen as, pretty straight and narrow civil servants who believe in labor law. They're there to enforce workers' rights. They tend to be more pro-worker, frankly, than the current administration. And so the employees representing the both the field staff and the headquarters staff of the National Labor Relations Board. There are two unions, the National Labor Relations Board Union and the National Labor Relations Board Professionals Association. They objected to this, and they believed that this was basically a power grab by political appointees who are at the head of the agency trying to undermine the career staff. And so eventually Peter Robb backed off of that plan, right? He basically sort of walked back that initiative, but in many other ways, the employees in my interviews with them had complained variously of feeling undermined, feeling pressured, feeling like, their work is becoming increasingly useless in some ways because, they may try to advocate for workers or, bring a case for an unfair labor practice at the regional level. But if Peter Robb ultimately has the final say on what happens to that case when it gets, when it gets above the regional level and perhaps comes before the board and you have a right wing board sort of dominating everything, then you can understand that they may feel a little bit gutted when it comes to carrying out their mission if they join the agency hoping to defend labor rights.
Michelle, you point out that several employees have left. Do we have a count on that? Is it significant to the point that they're not going to be able to fulfill their mission?
It's the National Labor Relations Board Union reported that there had been a pretty significant decline in staff since fiscal year 2017. They had counted about a 20% reduction in staff. And we're only really talking about there were over 900 field staff before, and that dropped to a little over 700. So you can imagine that, that's a pretty significant decline for a staff that is not that large, covering, all private sector workers in the country, right? And so the field staff have been feeling, overwhelmed. Meanwhile, there's been pressure to speed up the processing of cases. And what happens with that is that if you feel like you're constantly under pressure to get an investigation done quickly, then, these are the field staff who are basically fielding complaints from workers who are bringing unfair labor practice charges. So you can imagine if, there are workers who, have trouble finding the time to really report out, what's been going on at their workplace, or there are multiple workers who are involved. Those investigations take time. And if the field staff feel like they need to zoom through something in a few weeks and they may not be able to interview all the people they need to interview as thoroughly as they want to, they may not get all the facts. And in the end, you know, it ends up being a lot of pressure on them to do more work with fewer resources, and many people fear that this is ultimately going to make their work suffer. I should say that the employees that I interviewed who are still there, I mean, they had been trying really hard to do their best for the workers who had come to them, and, you know, they had been making a pretty valiant effort, but they did feel that that their work was being basically disrespected on multiple levels by the higher ups at their agency. And I should note that, you know, the unions have been pushing back pretty significantly, not on, you know, the substance of what the agency has been doing in terms of their decisions, but just in terms of trying to bring their case to Congress, saying that the agency is being undercut by the general counsel, that the agency is not being properly funded. And so they've been advocating for more resources. And ironically, you know, the heads of this agency don't seem to be that interested in fully funding their own agency. So
you can
make of that what you will.
Boy, if there's any time that this agency should be beefed up, it's now in the middle of a pandemic when you got so many workers deemed essential trying to do their job as safely as possible. And here the NLRB says if you speak out about it, you could be fired and should be fired. I mean, that's the sad part about it. We have a couple of minutes left here. Scabby the Rat. In fact, you start your article out, and I'm very familiar with Scabby the Rat. We have a lot of construction trade unions on the show, and Scabby is a favorite. It's gone from place to place, city to city, and it does generate a whole lot of attention. There's no doubt about it. But the National Labor Relations Board is now looking into getting rid of Scabby. Is that the story?
Yeah, since basically he took office pretty early on, Peter Robb made it clear that he had kind of a vendetta against Scabby the Rat. I should say that, you know, past Labor Relations Board have taken up this case. Employers have tried to bring cases before the agency, complaining that this was it was unfair of labor unions to try to engage in this kind of what they would refer to as kind of low grade harassment by putting this giant inflatable rat in front of workplaces that refuse to use union labor. So just for your readers who are not familiar, Scabby the Rat is a gigantic inflatable rat, and unions have often used them to basically remind the public that a certain company has not been using union labor at their mm-hmm. workplace. And so, Scabby the Rat kind of stands as a symbol of, scabs. So Peter Robb has been trying to bring cases that would basically potentially ban Scabby the Rat nationwide under the National Labor Relations Act. I should say here that, the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRB, they sort of waver politically from administration to administration. We're uh-huh. currently seeing sort of the extreme right-wing swing of the agency now, but the National Labor Relations Act, it has come under criticism throughout its history as something of a double-edged sword, because as you can see, it's really subject to politicization as long as it, has to deal with these cases through the National Labor Relations Board, which is always stacked with political appointees. And also the National Labor Relations Act, which was amended by the Taft-Hartley Act. After World War II, it really became more or less, in many cases, an apparatus for management to basically curtail the rights of unions. And the history of Scabby the Rat, I think, kind of speaks to how precarious union rights are when it comes to free speech in the workplace. I mean, it really does come down to the right of workers to express themselves against bosses. And when you can't even, set up an inflatable rat in the street, what can you do, really?
It definitely garnered a lot of attention, no doubt about that. Well, we're going to leave it on that note. Michelle, thank you so much for your time. Michelle Chen, writer with The Nation magazine, and the latest article is Trump's National Labor Relations Board is sabotaging its own mission. Lots of good insight there. It's hard to believe that the guy, the general counsel, Peter Robb, is the same guy that fired the air traffic controllers in 1981 under the Reagan administration, but that's the tone for labor in America today. Michelle, thank you so much. Keep in touch with us, okay?
All right, thanks a lot.
Once again, Michelle Chen on behalf of The Nation magazine. All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, latest from the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.